too. So thank you very much for coming to my talk, even though it's a little bit off the central topic of the conference. I'm going to talk about how the limits of the eigenvalue process of random matrices can be understood in terms of certain objects that you could think of as continuum limits of the matrices themselves. So let's start with this paper. So this is the title of Wigner's paper that sort of started random matrix theory in mathematics. And the main subject was to study the spacing distribution of eigenvalues of a large matrix. And from that, basically by analogy, say something about the distribution of the width of spacings of nuclear resonance level. There's also an underlying philosophy, which is that these two things should be in the same universality class, and there should be a principle of universality that applies to both of them. So my talk is going to be more or less about these spacings and their limits, and but I want to just mention that this universality is still mostly open. That is, even if you go in the world of random matrices, the basic universality questions about the spacings has not been proved. So here is I'm going to talk about the limit of the Poincaré of eigenvalues. And the way this talk is set up is that I'll talk about the most basic model, and I give some motivation by giving lots of examples of why. And these examples actually illustrate the idea of Wigner was more or less correct. There is some kind of universality that underlies these distributions, at least in the sense that they appear in many seemingly different contexts. And then I'm going to talk about two new approaches of understanding these distributions and these limiting point processes. And the two approaches are slightly different based on whether you're looking at bulk or edge limits. Now the first approach will be joint work with Bernard Aquarco, who's a postdoc here, a very strong one, in fact. So here's the basic model, which is, let's say, GUE. So you just take a matrix, fill in with IID complex Gaussian entries, and you standardize, and you symmetrize it. So you get the Hermitian matrix, and it's called unitary ensemble because it's invariant under unitary conjugation. And the GUE is, of course, the same with reals. Here's an example of the GUE. And so if you look at the eigenvalues, they form a point process which for finite n, there's an n by n matrix and there are n points in this point process. And you can describe the joint distribution, which is simply some normalizing constant times the van der Mond squared in the case of GUE and van der Mond in the case of GUE, and in general beta, it's van der Mond to the beta power. And some underlying product measure. So in this particular case, the product measure is Gaussian with a certain variance. Now, I told you about this in terms of matrices, but of course, this makes sense for general beta. Even if you don't start from a matrix model, you can just look at this distribution of points, and you can ask questions about it. So the kind of questions we want to address is what kind of limiting point processes can we get? So when as n goes to infinity. So of course, in order to get a limit when n goes to infinity, what you have to do is choose a window, a location over the window for every n, and then she's a scaling, and you take her eigenvalue process, which is lambda n, so I think of lambda n here as a random set of points. You center at your location here, say this is location, and then you scale by a certain factor. If we want to, so this is the typical scaling in the bulk, is you pick some location which is on the macroscopic scale between -1 and 1. As you know, the distribution of the eigenvalues converges to semicircle law, so that sort of tells you how to scale after that. Here, this is a semicircle factor, and so you do this kind of transformation of your process, and then you let n go to infinity and see what kind of limits you can have. You can do the same with the edge, and then if you like, you know, if you want to see what is the general scaling, so the general scaling, I mean actually general bar scaling here, you can just choose a window for each n, a location for each n, and look at your process at that particular location. If I want the limit to be, in this case I want the limit to be like the bulk, I want to make sure that we keep far enough from the edge. And this actually is the right condition for that, the minimal condition. And we're going to look at these processes, how they go, as one goes to infinity. So the limits of these processes are known for beta equals 1, 2, and 4, and they can be called sine beta or A beta point processes. And just an example, for example, when beta equals 2, 2 is a very special case, you end up with a determinantal projection process, and this is the projection kernel. It's basically a projection to space of functions whose Fourier transform vanishes outside a certain interval. So beta was a parameter, and okay, let me say a few more things. So here's this is the joint density of the points. Right? So it's just a Vandermonde with respect to some product measure. So you can think of the points living according to this product measure. So they're independent, but you put in an extra factor so that they repel each other. And beta, if beta equals 2, it comes from a GOE. If beta equals 1, it comes from a GOE. And of course, one thing that you already notice is that for different betas, you expect to have different limits of these point processes. Because if you look at, you know, what is the chance that there are two points being very, very close to each other, that will be governed by this beta, and that will not disappear, even if you take the limits. So you don't have this kind of universality. The betas, GA and GUE, are different. Okay, so let me talk a little bit about this sine process, and because this is one of the things I'm going to give a new representation for. And here is, you know, one of the most famous facts or conjectures about it, which is that you can get it from the Riemann zeta function. So what do you do? Let's say that these are the zeros of the Riemann zeta function. So Z, I think of it as a deterministic set. So then you pick a uniform random variable, and you recenter and a T which goes to infinity, and then you look at the zero sets at a random point from 0 to T. Okay. And then there is a certain centering. You have to multiply by log T. The fact that the asymptotic density of points is log T is actually due to Riemann. In fact, it's part of the sentence in which he introduced the Riemann hypothesis. So that's the Montgomery conjecture. In fact, the precise Montgomery conjecture is in terms of correlations, but this is a version of it which is perhaps more suitable in this setting. So here's another other appearance of the sine two-point process. which is due to Cedric Boutillier. So he introduced the following model. So you have beads, so you have lines, and on the lines you have beads. Now, these beads are done, are conditioned to have a certain structure. There is, if you look at this bead, so if you look at, and then this is in between these. So the beads are interlaced, I guess that's the simplest thing. So as you go from the next level, there's interlacing these lines. Now you can also put a probability distribution on them, but say that this is on the entire plane. Now say that we fix some kind of density. So say the density on each line, the intensity of the point process, so the average number of points per unit interval is 1. But then you give a probability distribution in the following way. You give it kind of good sense. That is, you give the conditional distribution of a point given the local structure. And that's what it, and the conditional distribution is the following. So given these, so you want to say, what is the distribution of this point? So given these 4 points, which put constraints on my current points, they have to be interlaced. Okay? They tell you that it has to be in a certain interval. In this particular case, they have to be in the interval determined by these 2 points. Right? It has to be in that interval for interlacing. So given that, it has to be uniform on that interval. So you could take that point, replace by a uniformly chosen point on that interval, and you would get the same distribution. So it's believed, although I think not strictly proved, that you suppose that you have such a probability distribution on these beads on the plane, and suppose that it satisfies the additional condition that it's symmetric under reflection along a vertical line. So one of the vertical axes. So the distribution will be the same after reflection. Not necessarily the process, but the distribution. So then, it turns out there should be a unique process satisfying these properties. And so that's one statement. And the second statement is, if you just look at on one line what happens, then what you get is the same as the GUE eigenvalues limit. So it's like a sine equals 2, the sine 2 process. So that's another description of the same process. But it's a little bit richer. there is another interesting thing connected to this picture, which is that if you look at values in a Young tableau, so let's say you have a Young tableau and it's drawn in a way that it's like this. So sitting on its corner, then if you look at the values on the Young tableau, then the condition for it to be a Young tableau or a standard Young tableau, I guess, is that those values are interlaced. Actually, it's exactly the same as it is for these beads. So right, so if you have a Young tableau, standard Young tableau, I draw it like this, then the condition on this value is that it has to be less than this and less than this and more than that and more than that. So it's exactly like the beads. So also, work in progress, we can prove that when you take a large Young tableau and you look at it in the middle, you pick one uniformly and look in the middle, then actually that converges to this bead process. So you can get GUE from Young tableaus as well, in that simple way. Okay, so here's another place where this distribution arises. So I'm going to talk about random polynomials. So if you have n points in the plane, there is a unique monic polynomial with the roots given by this n point. So you can think of the coordinates. You can think of the coefficients of this polynomial as some kind of coordinate system in which you describe those endpoints. So a natural question is, what happens if you put a uniform measure on the coefficients? So you want to take these endpoints in a way that it's sort of uniformly distributed. It is uniformly distributed coordinates. That's a very natural question. And so what you would like to do, you know, there isn't really a uniform measure because it lives on a complex number, so you could prove a Lebesgue measure. Now, then you have an infinite measure. You have an infinite measure on sets of points, but you can make it finite by putting a certain constraint on the points. So suppose that you fix a curve, and what you're going to do is you're going to make sure that these points are sitting in an epsilon neighborhood of the curve. So if you put this condition, then suddenly, you know, you've thrown away all but finite part of your Lebesgue measure. So you actually have a finite measure, so you can think of it as a probability measure after normalization. So you basically conditioned your points to be in the neighborhood of this curve and normalize. And so, you know, then you can let epsilon go to zero and you get a distribution on pointlets of a curve. So it's very easy to prove that this distribution is really just uniform measure on the curve times the van der Moen squared of the points. So uniform product measure on the curve times the van der Moen squared. So if you, for example, if you make the curve to be a circle, then this random set of points has the same distribution as the eigenvalues of a hard unitary matrix. And locally, it looks exactly like a GUE block, and if you take a limit, it will look the same as, it will have this sine 2 process. But this is another appearance of this. This gives you, you know, one way of, so this process is, you know, one way of saying it is, one way of calling it is random analytic zeros forcing a curve. So you basically pick a random analytic function in a nice way, and it forces zeros, random polynomial in a nice way, and forces zeros to be on a curve. So the Montgomery conjecture says that the Riemann zeta zeros behave like that, just like random analytic zeros forcing a curve. Which is perhaps, you know, you would say, "Well, that's my first guess, right? You see a lot of zeros, and of course it's a posteriori guess. It's easy." Okay, so I'll give you now a way to describe this set of points on a line. But so it's sort of a, I'm going to talk about something different first. So I guess just the hyperbolic plane, I'm sure you all know this stuff. So I'm looking at the Poincaré model of the hyperbolic plane. So it's just like the Euclidean plane, but the geometry is slightly different. You can model it in the unit disk by introducing this metric. So the hyperbolic distance is this factor times the Euclidean distance locally. And this way you can measure length and so on. So for example, all these fish on the hyperbolic plane are the same size. So the geometry of the hyperbolic plane is very similar to the Euclidean one. You have rotations and translations. But there are also some new phenomena like points at infinity and parallel displacement, and it turns out to be a much bigger space in some sense, that it's non-amenable. But there is a process that I want to describe to you, and that's called the hyperbolic carousel. So you have this hyperbolic plane, and you're given two parameters. The first one is a path in the hyperbolic plane, and the second one is a speed function. And from these two parameters, the hyperbolic carousel will produce you a set of points on the real line. Okay. Actually, a multi-set. So how does it go? So let's see. You have your path. And you do the following. So you move along this path at unit speed, and then you follow a boundary, a point on the boundary. So let's say you start with a fixed point on the boundary, And as you move along the path, you rotate that point on the boundary at a certain speed. Now the center of rotation is going to be where you are. So it makes a difference where you are because you're in hyperbolic geometry. In Euclidean geometry, you could do the same, it wouldn't make a difference, but here it does. And the speed of the rotation is going to be lambda times ft. The lambda is something that you can set in the beginning. So, okay, so you do this, your point goes around a few times. So, at time infinity, you're going to see how many times it went around. So you've got to get an integer valued winding number for the point. So this is well defined. And we're going to call this n lambda, because it depended on my choice of lambda, which is a factor that comes before the speed here. So now what happens with this? So now you look at n lambda as a function of lambda. Okay. So you see that if you increase lambda, that means you're rotating faster around the circle. So that means your n lambda is going to increase. It definitely cannot decrease. Right. So n lambda is a monotone increasing function, or non-decreasing. So non-decreasing function of lambda, and it's integer valued, right? So what it does, it jumps, right, to some places, and that's where your points are. So you're going to define your set of points as the point process which this n lambda counts. Okay, so that's the hyperbolic cosine. And here is also, now you can also write a differential equation for this, of course. So suppose that, you know, you have to choose some, so this was defined in terms of the hyperbolic plane, but you can go to the Poincaré model to introduce coordinates. And suppose that your point on the boundary is this, then given B, this is the differential equation that it satisfies. So essentially, the point moves lambda times f, and then there is a factor which has to do with what your location is. And as you imagine, this the speed at which you have to rotate this point or move this point in the unit disk coordinate system, well, you have to introduce sort of a change of coordinates which has to do with the Poisson kernel. And every time you change coordinates in the hyperbolic plane, it comes in. So you get some expression in terms of the Poisson kernel. Well, I'm not there yet, so so far it's very deterministic, but yes, the answer is yes. So let me show you how it works, just so that, let's see. Okay, so you have this point rotating around. So this is all seen in the Poincaré model. Now, if you're really near the boundary in the Poincaré model, then your point, then the rotation will remove points that are away from you by a much faster speed than points that are close to you. So that's the kind of...
The idea of using the
Poincaré
method is that it takes an infinite amount of time to get to the boundary.
Well, no. I mean, the fact that you're using the hyperbolic plane is crucial. It's part of the, you know, if you use some other geometry, you get something completely different. So yes, I guess it's
it's a process that internal that structures implies the hyperbolic planes. So I don't know. This is okay. So I mentioned here hyperbolic Brownian motion. That's going to be our path, and so here's hyperbolic Brownian motion. It's just ordinary Brownian motion, but the increments, you know, how much you jump at a given time, depends on your location. So in the Poincaré model, this is the equation for it. As you get closer to the boundary, you move slower. So it is true that it takes infinite amount of time to get to the boundary. And it's also true that if it's very closely related, maybe this is what you're mentioning, it's very closely related to Euclidean Brownian motion. You can construct it. So you just run a Euclidean Brownian motion until you hit the boundary of the disk, and then you reparametrize time this way. So this parametrization is always going to give you an infinite interval from the finite interval. So here's a theorem. So I guess I have to tell you what this MN is. And the MN was 2 square root of N minus mu N times N to the 1/6. So the statement is, so remember MN, mu n was the location of your scaling window. It was dependent on n. So the theorem says that this location of the scaling window can be anywhere, as long as it doesn't get close to the edge, because then you start picking up edge behavior. And this is true for general beta. Then the rescaled eigenvalue process converges to the points of the hyperbolic carousel, driven by hyperbolic Brownian motion, and then the speed function. Okay, so the speed function is essentially exponential with a parameter. This is the density of exponential distribution with parameter beta over 4. That's your speed function. So there is another way you can write this. I have described to you this process in terms of a hyperbolic Brownian motion. Right? So you give me a hyperbolic Brownian motion path, and I transform it so that you get this point process on the real line, which is the sine beta point process for general beta. It's a deterministic transformation, and it goes by solving an ODE. An ordinary differential equation. So there is no subtlety in terms of probability, or you don't need to use stochastic differential equations of any kind. So you just start, it's all ordinary differential equations. But sometimes you can take an ordinary differential equation and transform it to a stochastic differential equation. And what you have to do in this case is to get a nice one is to follow a different kind of angle, and the angle that you're following now is the angle as seen from the position of where you are at given time. So that's going to be alpha rather than the original gamma. And then you see what you get when you do that. You get this kind of stochastic differential equation. So the change in alpha is some lambda times this speed function f plus this is a complex Brownian motion. You have to have to multiply by this factor, and then you take a real part. If you fix lambda, then this, so you fix, you know, remember lambda was the parameter of n, so you're looking at a fixed lambda, then this complex Brownian motion here can be replaced by a real Brownian motion, because you're taking the real part of the complex Moise term, so that will be just real. So what you get here is this so-called stochastic sine equation, which describes a certain process. So the stochastic sine equation looks like this. The change in alpha is this exponential factor plus some noise. So I'm going to talk a little bit about this, what it looks like, but let's see, just to connect it in a very concrete way to what I've been talking about, the property that this alpha satisfies is that at infinity, once it, so if it converges to a value, and if you divide that value by 2 pi, then you get the random variable. The random variable will have the same distribution as the number of eigenvalues in an interval 0 lambda in the limiting process. Okay. So what is this stochastic sine equation? So let me just start with the simplest, start with something very simple. So maybe you have seen this stochastic differential equation. This is some very dumb model for the stock market. So the change in the price of the stock is the price of the stock times some little noise. So this is kind of a continuous martingale, so you'll have to local martingale to converge to zero with probability one by standard theorems. Martingale convergence theorem. Actually, the martingale convergence theorem tells you that it converges to somewhere. But you see that the only place it can converge to is zero, because if it converges to some other number, then you would still have a noise term there, which means it would still have to change. And if this didn't vanish, then it would still have to change. So that shows you that the only place it can converge to is zero. In general, the only place these things can converge to is where this coefficient vanishes before the noise term. So here I'm going towards the stochastic sine equation. So previously this differential equation, you had to start at some positive value, otherwise it would just get stuck at zero. But one thing you can do is to add a little bit of drift up so that you can start at zero and you'll be able to escape from zero. So here's this little drift. It's exponential. Its total integral is one, so it doesn't really, it's not going to make your influence your process a lot. Initially it would have some influence. And it's still, almost a martingale. It will still have this property that it will have to converge to a point and so on. And the next one is the stochastic sine equation, which I have all the parameters put in. So you just have this same exponential drift, and then the term before the noise is sine rather than alpha itself. So this process has to converge to some zero of the sine, okay? So some multiple of pi. And the actual one looks like this, which has to converge to a multiple of 2 pi. So that's what it is. And so you run this process, and the only thing you're interested in is its limit at infinity. So I have some simulation for that. This is stochastic sine equation. So this is this curve. If you look at the fixed point, then that fixed point performs satisfies the stochastic differential equation. So, and when a fixed point is a value at say minus 10, it satisfies the stochastic differential equation with minus 10 as lambda. So this is sort of a stochastically evolving curve as a function of lambda, and at infinity it goes to the step function which counts your eigenvalues. Excuse me? Okay, so this SDE here, it's a little bit messy, but this is just an exponential with parameter beta over 4, and this is just a sine. Now, this is the SDE for a fixed lambda. But they're not coupled through this equation. They're coupled through the original expression, which I had up here before. They're coupled through this one. For fixed lambda, that gives you the right thing, but but not for general lambda. So you actually need a complex Brownian motion to describe your process. A real Brownian motion is enough for just describing a number of points in an interval, which is, you know, a much lower dimensional thing. And this is with parameter 1. There is one with parameter 3. You actually have a kind of phase transition at parameter 2. Just can't try to guess in the picture, but... You can see that, I think even this picture is sort of, you can see that the points with beta equals 3 are more regular than at beta equals 1. As beta increases, the points become more regular, and in fact, as beta goes to infinity, you get just periodic points. As beta goes to 0, you get a Poisson process, which is no repulsion. Okay. So where does all this come from? The idea is essentially, I mean, the starting idea or useful idea is due to the Trotter in 1982, which is that you can represent GOE and GUE as a tri-diagonal matrix. So you can have a tri-diagonal matrix which has the same eigenvalue distribution as GOE and GUE. And what Edelman and Dimitri did later was to show that this is true actually for general beta. And it's much more interesting because in general beta there is no matrix to start with, right? All you have is this distribution of points, and the matrix is but they can still construct a matrix. Yes. So the G's, the G's are normal and independent with variance two, and the chi's are. Let's see. The chi's are chi distributions. So chi n is the length of a standard Gaussian vector in n space, and if n is not an integer, well, you can do it as a square root of a gamma variable. And so I can tell you how this goes because it's very simple. So how do you do it? How can you prove this for, say, GOE? Okay, so if you have two matrices, A, which is a symmetric matrix, say, and O, which is an orthogonal matrix of this form. So A is general. I just denoted these entries by these different letters, but O has to have this form. You have a 1 and you have an O11. So when you conjugate A, then of course the eigenvalues don't change, but the form of A changes. And so what happens is the submatrix first gets rotated by that submatrix there, which is also orthogonal. So it doesn't change. So it just gets conjugated. And these vectors B, they get rotated. And A doesn't, this A11 doesn't change. So that's just how it changes. Now, if this is actually a matrix which comes from the GOE, then what you have here is just a vector of normals. So you can choose your O so that it rotates this vector of normals into the first coordinate. Okay, so and then its distribution will be chi and minus 1 because that's the length of the vector. Now you have chosen O so that it was, you didn't look at A11 when you chose O. Right? You looked at this, it's O is random, but it doesn't depend on A11. So that means when you conjugate this A by O, then you still have a GOE as a submatrix here. because you conjugation by a fixed orthogonal matrix doesn't change the distribution, and a conjugation by an independent orthogonal matrix also doesn't change the distribution. So then you just iterate and see what you get, right? So Brian Sussman at MIT in his thesis has this idea to when you have a tridiagonal matrix, it feels like a differential operator, right? Sort of a discrete time model for a differential operator, and you could take the limit as you could take the limit and get a limiting differential operator, and hopefully the eigenvalues of the operator will and of this limiting operator will describe the limit of the eigenvalues of the original operator. So it turns out that it doesn't quite work for the bulk this way. You'd have to do it differently, but you can do it with P, but you can actually do it this in the on the edge. Now the tridiagonal nature of these matrices is actually a good help for you. Because originally your matrix had, if you looked at the eigenvectors of the matrix, the eigenvectors of the GOE is just a random orthonormal frame in R2DN, independent of the eigenvalues. So not especially interesting. But here, the eigenvectors are not independent of the eigenvalues at all. They have a lot of structure. So actually, if you draw what an eigenvector is, so this is a picture of an eigenvector. It's a 200 by 200 matrix. And what I did is I plotted, you know, the first entry, the second entry, the third entry, and so on, of the eigenvector. And so you get some kind of messy picture. So, you know, if you want to understand this in the limit, this picture doesn't look that good. But you can transform it in some way, and then you get something more tractable. So essentially, when you want to solve... when you want to find an eigenvector of a tridiagonal matrix, what you typically do is you shoot. So you set a few initial values, maybe two in this case, and then the next value is determined to you by the first line of the equation, and then the second line, and so on. So you can develop your eigenvectors, and all your equations will be satisfied. And this kind of thing is a free-term recursion in this particular case. Okay, so you get a free-term recursion. And then whether it's an eigenvector or not is actually depends on whether in the end there is a special equation with one term cut off. So that has to be satisfied. Yeah? So in the previous picture, I can say it again. So here this is a picture of the eigenvector. For every number between 1 and 200 at the ith location, I drew the ith entry of the eigenvector. I think of the eigenvector as a function of the entry. And this is a graph of that function. This okay? Yes, so the fact that there is a long tail has to do with that you're not in the center of the block. So the length of the tail tells you where you are. So it's maybe the eigenvector for, you know, lambda roughly here. And this is the semicircle, you know, minus 2. And so we study this kind of recursion. I don't know if I want to say a lot more. Essentially, when you study recursions, three-term recursions especially, it turns out that a hyperbolic setting is very natural to understand what happens. For example, if you follow the ratio of the entries, so V1 over V2 and V2 over V3 and so on, you get a two-term recursion, so one is just a function of the previous one. And the function is a linear fractional transformation fixing the real line. Okay? So you have a sequences of LFTs, linear fractional transformation fixing the real line. So you compose these things. And you know, the linear fractional transformation fixing the real line are are the automorphisms of the hyperbolic plane in the upper half plane model. And that's how, that's where all this comes from. Okay, I have maybe 5 more minutes. I wanted to give one proof. So I'll say a little bit about what happens at the edge, and this is joint work with Brian Ryder and Jose Ramirez. So in the edge you have, again, the same matrix. Maybe I'm missing a 1 over square root of B factor. And now you really can think of this as a differential operator. And you just rescale. So you rescale. It's x on the integer. You rescale the integers to get the reals. You rescale the matrix to get an operator. And this is how you rescale. And we show that in the limit, this converges to the eigenvalues, and also the eigenvectors converge to the solutions of the eigenvalues of, and the eigenvectors of the certain stochastic differential operator. This acts on the positive real line, and there's a boundary condition which is your function. So it actually acts on the functions which are zero, at zero, and live in this space, H1 local. So it's functions whose derivative is locally in L2. So this is an this operator is a little bit, it's not especially nice in terms of regularity. Because what it does is it takes a function whose derivatives are in L2 locally, and maps it to a function whose integral is in L2 locally. So in fact, that may not even be a function, but that's okay. it maps it to a formal derivative of a function which is in L2 locally. And I can specify such a function, of course, by specifying its integral. It's indefinite integral. And the indefinite integral is given by this formula. So I just take this and do integration by parts. Just multiply this by f and do integration by parts, and I get this formula. So it's, I've defined this to you as an operator which takes a relatively nice function and sends us to a relatively ugly function, which may not even be a function, so actually a distribution. But it may happen to be a function, and it may happen to be the same as you started with, times the constant, and then it's an eigenvalue. And it's an eigenvector, which that constant is an eigenvalue. And so, so this beta here is a parameter before the noise. If I erase all the stochastic term, then you just get the Airy differential equation. One of the solutions of this is this Airy function. And the eigenvectors of the Airy functions are, they look like, you just take, of this operator on the positive half line, they look like you start the this Airy function at some point, push that point to zero, and then erase the tail. So that's the kind of things as you get as eigenvectors, and you can think of these random eigenvectors as some perturbations of that. One of the things that you can prove using this representation is chaos for a general Tracy-Widom distribution. So Tracy-Widom distributions are the limit of the largest eigenvalue distribution of a random matrix. And it also comes up as limits of other things, especially in the beta equals 1 and beta equals 2 case, but we have defined it for general beta. And the tails can be understood. The tails are very interesting, as you see. One is sub-Gaussian, the other the case, but slower than Gaussian, depending on which direction you go to. So it is with the constants, you can easily deduce it from this stochastic representation. So maybe I will say one proof if I can say it fast enough, and then I finish. So here is my operator. And you remember that the statement is the trace of it on beta is just, so you look at the largest eigenvalue of this operator, actually take its negative, and that's going to be trace of it on distribution with beta. So the chance that this eigenvalue is less than minus eta, so the fact that this eigenvalue is, the trace of them is small, the same that the top eigenvalue is big, which means that you can plug in any test function and you form this ratio. Right, the top eigenvalue is the infimum of all these ratios of all functions. So definitely this is an upper bound, the chance that this is greater than A, using the variational characterization. Okay, so I just did that. So now what do? I just express these two quantities. Okay, so H times F, well, I just plug in the F and I do the integration. I get this thing. Okay. Can do it too, you believe me, this is true. So as you see, this is the integral of the square of F, sorry, of the derivative, this is integral of the square. And here I've moved this F of F over here and this inner product there and done the integral. So this is just deterministic depending on F. This is deterministic depending on F. This is deterministic depending on F. And this is a random quantity depending on F, but it's a Gaussian because I'm just integrating white noise with respect to some weight. And the weight is just, related to integral of F to the fourth. So this event has the same probability for a fixed F as I just replace here the Gaussian by G, which is a normal Gaussian times its standard deviation, and then I get this inequality. So I get a Gaussian tail kind of estimate. So this is true for any F, this inequality. So the probability is bounded by this probability with plugging any F there. And if I do this optimization, which gives me the largest value here, then I can get the right constant for the tail bounds. So it's extremely simple. You get this in one place from really Gaussian tail bounds, and it's much harder to do if you use any other methods. So that's it. Thank you very much.